Welcome back to Get Psyched.
Brought to you by PsychSign. I'm your host, Arazu, and today we're infusing the world of psychiatry with a flavorful twist, nutritional psychiatry. We're joined by two fantastic guests, Dr. Tan Nguyen, who brings a wealth of knowledge from his child and adolescent training at the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, and Dr. Bhagwan Baru, a forensic psychiatrist with deep insights into addiction psychiatry. Together, they shed light on how our gut microbiome, a vast and intricate ecosystem of bacteria, interacts with the brain. Nutritional psychiatry challenges us to consider how food affects more than our physical health. This emerging field suggests that our dietary choices, from simple sugars to complex fats, can have profound effects on mood and mental well-being. Dr. Baru adds depth to our conversation by examining how diet may shape addictive behaviors, while Dr. Nguyen offers perspective on the complex interplay of food, culture, and mental health, advocating for the potential of nutritional interventions in psychiatric care. For those looking to expand their knowledge, Dr. Baru is working on a groundbreaking textbook on nutritional psychiatry, courtesy of an invitation by the American Psychiatric Association. This text is set to become an essential resource for clinicians who aim to integrate dietary considerations into psychiatric treatment. As we explore this complex relationship further, nutritional psychiatry emerges as a critical consideration in our mission to understand and enhance mental health. Stay tuned and get psyched to nourish your mind with this fascinating topic. Welcome back to the PsychSign podcast. Today, I'm joined by two very special guests to talk about nutritional psychiatry. Dr. Tan Nguyen is a lieutenant in the United States Navy and in his last year of child and adolescent psychiatry fellowship at the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. This is where he met Dr. Bhagwan Baru, a forensically trained psychiatrist with a love for sharing his knowledge, expertise, and curiosities to medical trainees and nationally at the APA, where his seminar on Food for Thought was featured as Course of the Month in 2022. This momentum has earned Dr. Baru an invitation by APA Publishing to spearhead a nutritional psychiatry textbook. First of all, congratulations for both of your work in this field. It's a rather newer field in psychiatry, and so I'm sure it can't be easy to get your foot in the ground in a field like this, but I think our listeners are very eager to learn more about this field where, you know, mental health and nutrition intersect. I know that personally I'm super interested in this topic of discussion. So kind of to kick things off, for our listeners who might be new to nutritional psychiatry, how would you define this field?
So before I answer this question, allow me to express my gratitude and thank you for inviting me today to speak on a subject that's so dear to me. Nutritional psychiatry is an upcoming field. It's a study and practice of utilizing food and food supplements as an integral aspect of the various complementary treatments, in addition to medications, psychotherapies, and lifestyle changes in the prevention and treatment of mental disorders. The discipline that informs us the benefits of adequate nourishment for maintaining good mental health and the harm that could come from malnutrition. In other words, nutrition should be considered as a modifiable risk factor for mental health and for disorders. There's an opinion given out by some mental health providers that food and food supplements could be utilized as an alternate treatment to mental health patients. That's not my opinion. I beg to differ because I would rather see foods helping medications and other complementary treatments in realizing the goal of good mental health. I have a firm belief that since many of the mental health conditions have multiple causative factors, there should be provided help from multiple modalities of treatment, such as medications, therapies, and also being provided advice regarding sleep, activities, including extracurricular activities, relationships, and of course, nutrition.
Thank you for that comprehensive definition. I really appreciate that you highlighted nutrition with regards to mental health, not as an alternative, but as a necessary component to consider when looking at the patient as a whole. I think that oftentimes as physicians, yes, we get very minimal training in discussing diet and exercise and lifestyle factors that contribute to disease, but do we really take the time to sit there and discuss exactly what patients are eating and what actually factors into their diets? No, I can't say that we do, at least from what I've seen on clinical rotation. I don't think that it's prioritized as much as I think it should be. And so I'm kind of curious to see, to kind of hear why you think that there's been a growing interest now in nutritional psychiatry.
It's very important that you ask that question, because as you know, this field is still in its infancy. But before I answer that question, let me take you back to times, prehistoric times. If you go back to most ancient civilizations, you will find that nutrition occupied a big part of treatment of any of those civilizations. This was before the time when medications were being manufactured and dispensed. At that time, all we had was food and food supplements. And they've almost been forgotten since the advent of pharmaceuticals. Recently, it has been found, rediscovered, this whole concept that food is an important aspect of health and that should not be ignored or relegated to the backseat. If you check out the ancient civilizations, three of them come to mind. The first one I would tell you, and I'm going to quote you statements from what was stated at that time. Around 300 BCE, there was text written by a physician by the name of Charak in what is now known as the Charak Samhita. And he states clearly, what does he state? That if you strive for bliss, your diet should be such that new disease cannot manifest and existing diseases alleviated. Imagine a more powerful statement about nutrition and disease. Taking you to China is an ancient Chinese proverb which says, he that takes medicine and he that takes medicine and neglects diet wastes the talents of the physician. Coming down to, of course, what is more popular in literature is the Greek thoughts. We follow Greek thoughts in plenty. So I'm going to quote you two of those. First one was the fact that let food be thy medicine, or else let medicine be thy food. While the statement is simple, it carries a very profound effect on what they thought about nutrition and malnutrition, both lower and higher, which means extra nutrition or undernutrition, both had to be taken into account. And of course, there's one another one, which is even more specific. Just as food causes chronic disease, and we know that one of them is obesity, as we say, it can be a most powerful cure. So what we are saying is food can cause an illness, but it can also cure it. These pearls of wisdom were lost with the progress of time as various medications kept getting invented and the importance of food took a backseat. It was unfortunate. Let's come to the 20th century. It was an American nutritionist by the name of Victor Landlord who published a book, You Are What You Eat. And he subtitled it with How to Win and Keep Health with diet. That, I would say, is the start of paying more and more attention to nutrition. And now we come to this century. Except for a couple of decades back, I have not found a single reference that refers to diet, nutrition, and mental health. But since then, there has been an upsurge of interest in this subject. One can say, use a cliche and say, what was once lost is found again. Many healthcare providers are now coming around to that fact that yes, nutrition is important. And while we have many sister specialties such as cardiology, GI, hematology, even endocrinology and neurology, who sometimes occasionally speak to patients about food and how it affects their conditions, and many a times refer them to nutritionists to get more advice. We are now coming to the understanding that psychiatry should not be left behind in this area, and that we as psychiatrists have an important role to play in advising patients what is good for their mental health and what is not. This is one more tool in our armamentarium, which we should utilize as often as we can to provide maximum benefit for our patients.
Thank you for the lessons in history. I think that everything you touched upon is so important to contextualize within history, because even though nutritional psychiatry is something that's emerged more recently in the scientific literature and at conferences and even the discussion we're having right now, like you said, it's so important to be able to look back and see that this information isn't new. Ancient civilizations long gone and long lost knew that this was important for all aspects of our health. And so it's so curious to think about now, when did we lose this knowledge? And you kind of touched upon it earlier, along with the pharmaceutical industry came a shift in mindset about health. It became more about pharmaceuticals and manufactured medications as opposed to the ABCs of health, you know, diet, sleep, and fitness that, you know, are instinctual to humans since the dawn of time, probably. And so it's funny how in such a short amount of time, you know, that the pharmaceutical industry has kind of sprung up and started to exert its influence on us as a society, that we all have had this huge shift in mind. And now it's time to unlearn some of that information and relearn and reconnect with our food as a medicine itself and as a place to build health instead of treating disease, and in the prevention of health specifically, or the prevention of disease specifically. I think it's all of what you said was so powerful and important to remember when contextualizing this newer field of nutritional psychiatry. And something that's kind of come into the conversation over and over and over again, something that's kind of a hot topic within the field of nutrition and, you know, relating to mental health and the connections that go on between our body, is the gut microbiome and how that either directly or indirectly affects our mental health. Can you shed some light on what that relationship is?
Yeah. So for folks out there hearing my voice for the first time, I am Lieutenant Nguyen. But yeah, I'm here with my partner in crime, Dr. Baru, who got me really fired up about this topic. And I think to answer one of your questions before about, like, how did such a high value in food as medicine get shifted away, like, disproportionately? Because if you think about what our day is, sometimes they're actually centered around the meals that we eat, right? Lunch. People gather for lunch, or people write notes before or after lunch. And we fail to kind of question the idea of what we're actually putting in our bodies. I think for us now, it's a little bit more of like a nuisance of like, man, I'm hungry. I got to get satiated and then I got to get back to work. For the microbiome, yes, that has become a much more and more hot topic as you intersect between psychiatry and nutrition, right? So I kind of want to start pretty big just to make sure that the folks that are listening kind of have a good idea, context, meaning of like some of the words that I'm saying, right? So for instance, when I say microbiome, what does that usually consist of? Most folks might see that as just the bacteria. However, this is actually to include the fungus that is around the area and the viruses that are either in the bacteria in the fungus or maybe in the epithelial that they're living on. And that segues me to another part of a microbiome, that a very important part of it is where that microbiome actually is in context, right? For instance, in our gut, which I think we'll talk about quite a bit today, right? We have the gut microbiome, but that's going to be very different from our like microbiome in our mouth or oral microbiome, right? Dentists know about that microbiome quite well, probably. I wish I knew more about it, as opposed to, say, something on our skin, right? And as you think about it, there are layers and layers and layers and layers and functions that the microbiome help us with, specifically in the gut. Taking us back all the way to like microbiology 101 is kind of the competition against other bugs that might not, or they're not supposed to be there, right? So just direct competition, and that's protective. Or early on in life, and as a budding child and adolescent psychiatrist, I'm very interested in the development of what that gut microbiome actually looks like interacting with us as we grow up. And one of the big things is actually the immunity function, where it lets our gut and all of the lymph players down there know what is maybe good and native and what is not, right? So, and a lot of that can probably change as well based on, I guess, delivery of how you came into this world, but I'm not going to get into that today. It has a very important function in helping us digest food, right? That's pretty basic. And that is to include like the vitamins, the minerals that it might provide for us. But I guess the bigger buzzword in the literature is actually short-chain fatty acids, and it's the fermentative byproducts of the microbiome. There are two other items where it can also affect neuroendocrine-wise. And specifically, we're talking about, say, insulin, right? When to actually have that insulin spike or have that insulin, I guess, slowly increase or not slowly increase. And ultimately, I think that affects our behavior as well. That is the 10,000-foot view. I think one of the most profound things that I have learned since being in med school and being in psychiatry is that 95% of our serotonin receptors live in the gut. Now, this is fascinating to me, right? Because for one thing, like, where's the other 5%? Probably in our brains, right? And when we talk about depression, when we talk about anxiety, when we talk about a neurobiochemical imbalance, we talk about serotonin, and we always think about it in like the aspect of the brain. And part of me always wonders, like, does the gut have anything to do with it? And does that translate into how we feel and think? I just can't ignore the idea that 95% of those receptors are there and they don't actually play a role into it. So I wonder if the future research of that should go into there.
Yeah, I think you gave a really great profile as to what specifically is going on in the gut, and not only some of the more like the biome of the gut, but also how does our gut interact with the microbiome? So the receptors involved, things like that. I think it's really important to have a baseline understanding of what's going on. But it's curious. I have the same questions as you. Like, what role do those receptors have to play? And I'm sure there's more questions and answers at this point, unfortunately. But as far as your learning has gone, have you learned about either direct or indirect relationships between the gut and mental health? For instance, a low diversity in your microbiome, is that related to increase in negative mental health outcomes?
Yes. Yes. So one of the things that you brought up that I've talked about before was something called dysbiosis, right? And what that really means is it doesn't necessarily address the idea that there might be like less diversity, but more so that the composition is not what it's supposed to be, like functionally, right? So let's say we have a microbe in there that usually outcompetes another one that is invasive. And now we have, for some reason, lost that population, and now this invasive bug has proliferated. I think the classic example in our studies is actually C. diff. And that has a lot to do with antibiotic use, right? So C. diff in itself, you know, you can make the argument that it's not like, it is bad, right? I mean, it is bad when someone's suffering from C. diff, right? But you can't say that the presence of it in itself, like just one microbe in your stomach, is going to cause the pathology that we see, right? It's usually the outcome is usually outcompeting, eventually leading to the production of the spores that leads to the sequelae. And some of it is unfortunately iatrogenic with antibiotics, which is one of the reasons why we have it as a risk factor.
While we're talking of mental health, let's not forget that the microbiome has multiple effects all over, which would include not just mental health, but neurology, immunology, and endocrinology. And as you know, immunology, endocrinology also affect mental health. It's not often that we think in those terms, but if we put all of this together as one body and one mind, in fact, I would say one mind in one body, then we get to see how each organ system affects every other organ system. We have seen so many cases where our immunology is not adequate, and it's either working overtime or less than adequate, and how mental health is also affected in those cases. I'll give you some classic examples, such as Parkinson's, which is in the realm of neurology. But how many Parkinson's patients also come up with effects in their mental health, which need psychiatric mental health? Autism, which we know is a neurological condition, but we do treat it because of its many different conditions. And these two are just neurology. What about hypothyroidism and its effects, and hyperthyroidism and its effects? What about cortisol, and what does that do to the mental health? And all of this gets affected by the gut microbiome. So what important role it plays is still to be discovered. Some people are of the opinion, though it's not fully agreed upon, is the microbiome could be considered as a separate organ system of the body.
Yeah, I think that, kind of to summarize, while we know that there is a connection between the gut microbiome and mental health and overall health, we haven't been able to identify the specific pathways in which they affect each other bidirectionally. And it isn't a linear connection either. Like you said, it impacts you, your hormones, it impacts yourself neurologically. And then those things come together to impact your mental health and vice versa. And so thank you to the both of you for explaining that, because I think we were able to get kind of a broader view of how the gut microbiome works, but also understand how this plays into disease pathology, which inevitably, I think that that's where the research needs to go, right? Looking at how these things affect specific disease processes so that we can look and say, this is where we need to make an intervention. This is where we need to adjust someone's either antibiotic intake, right? Which we're always trying to minimize as providers.
I hope the IG docs out there know that I believe in the stewardship, all right?
Right. Or whether it's a nutritional intervention or pharmaceutical or what have you, I think that you have to start somewhere. And we're looking at page one right now, unfortunately. But it's a great place to start.
And the only other thing I would add is, you know, when people think about our gut as like, a, you know, like our second brain, I actually argue it was actually our first brain, because evolutionarily, the thing that developed first was the system of saying good food, bad food, nutritious, toxic, through the GI tract. And then slowly but surely, I'm sure the vagal nerve had something to do with it, it made its way up and developed the rest of our neural system. But that's maybe that's the reason why there is that gut feeling. If not, you know, hopefully someone will send me an email about that.
Like correction. No, I think that we're on such new frontiers. It's okay if we make a mistake or two.
Fallibility. It's a great thing.
I actually do love that you mentioned that though, because I myself, I'm super interested in learning about things within the context of evolutionary medicine and thinking about how human health has over time been impacted by the course of our evolution, both biologically and socially. And it's interesting you pointed out, yes, like the two organ systems that developed hand in hand in utero and then in early stages of infancy are the neurological system and the gut system, right? Those are the first two that develop in utero. And so it is interesting that you see that. And it does beg the question of how intertwined are these two systems? Is it fair to call it a second organ? What Dr. Baru is saying about it being the second brain versus, or it being the first, which is it? We don't know. But I think it is an interesting question, something you don't even think about necessarily, but it is cool to see how a lot of these ideas are natural to us. We do think about our gut feeling, you know, and that's something that everyone's experienced. And yet, it only took us so many years to figure out that there might actually be a connection, right? When we knew all this time.
Yeah. And to also just give you an idea of like how the microbiome is studied. You know, it is bacteria through the 16S ribosome, I guess, fingerprint that they do where they make sure that if they were to take a sample, they run through the 16S ribosome of what's actually there, and then they match it with actual microbe. I say that because that probably takes a lot of computer power that we might have not had beforehand. And that resource in itself of, I guess, big data that can be extracted from that. You know, I bet you we were curious. We just might have not had the capability to say like, ha, look, see, Neisseria definitely is overtaking like Staphylococcus or E. coli.
Right. Yeah. That's an important thing to point out is just our capabilities, right? I mean, even 50 years ago, we weren't able to sequence human genome, right? So the progress is exponential. And so I'm sure that plays a huge role into it. And I think something that a lot of people don't necessarily talk about is the financial incentive. What drives research and development in a lot of fields, including medicine, is the financial incentive. And so food is maybe not the most profitable industry and maybe not as profitable as the pharmaceutical industry. And so these are just things that I think about in terms of maybe that's played a role in why we're not further along in our understanding of some of these things, but that's neither here nor there. So not for us to spend too much time thinking about. I think it's more important that we use our skill set to look at the research and implement interventions. I did have some more specific questions that I know we're going to be challenging to answer because of the lack of information that we have at our disposal, but I'm just curious to see what the literature does say at the moment. So in your research, have you observed any distinct impacts of substances, either illicit or non-illicit, on the gut microbiome or on the, I guess, intersection of nutrition, mental health in general?
Yeah. Fantastic question. And I'll actually talk about alcohol because we talk about licit and illicits, right? And we're talking about legality. So alcohol, it can be too much, it can be just enough, or it can just be completely wrong because you're underage and you're not supposed to be drinking it. So it really all depends on the context that you put it in. However, that is a very important word that I want to like put stop, and that is the word context, right? I'll get into that a little bit more, but I'll first kind of describe the irony that I see with alcohol. If there are some food recommendations that is kind of like kind of persisted for a while, it is that there are benefits to eating fermented food, right? So we're talking kimchi, we're talking yogurt. There are many fermented breads out there that that is escaping my mind right now. However, that process and that product, we've seen to improve maybe some of the diversity of the microbiome, as well as have better health outcomes. Now, the irony that I want to point out is that ethanol, or you know, alcohol, whatever, is a that byproduct of fermentation itself, right? However, we do not treat it within the same realm. And my argument is that it is taken well out of context, right? We've taken that ethanol that was once maybe in the kimchi or in the grapes, right? And we've taken that and we've just distilled it into our own little thing and we've added sugar. So with that being said, because how easily accessible it is and how concentrated it is, right? And evolutionarily, I don't think people millennia ago were drinking Grey Goose. But that is to say, there is some data out there, more so proof of concept, to say if you have this substance that selects for a certain number of microbes in a microbiome, chances are those are the ones that will stick around. The question becomes, are they good or bad? And the study that I found, they looked at a 2018 study, they looked at the composition of mild, moderate to heavy alcohol consumers. And then they looked as to how their microbiome changed over time. One of the things is that they noticed that the commensal lactobacillus they went away. And the thing that it was replaced with was the microbes that used ethanol as the substrate. Specifically, the one that I want to highlight is Neisseria. So that usually is not coming up in a good context in a hospital if you see the word Neisseria. And in this context, it's using that ethanol to turn it into acetaldehyde, which we know is carcinogenic. It just reinforces the idea that anything alcohol touches sometimes can lead to cancer. But all that's to say that when it comes back to your question, right, context is going to be the number one thing you want to think about when it comes to substances or foods that you take in. And then secondly, the amount and how much it changes the microbiome will all be dependent on what's already there. You know, I can get into antibiotics as well, but something tells me many have already gotten to the idea of antibiotics might not be the best for the microbiome. Maybe that's why we're trying these prebiotic things, as well as knowing how to address microbial antibiotic stewardship. And then last but not least, for all the other illicits that other folks might be thinking about, heroin, cocaine. It changes the gut microbiome. How much data is there on there and specifically what? I haven't found a really good convincing explanation of it yet, but I guess qualitatively the answer is yes.
Yeah, I think that probably applies to everything we put in our bodies, right? It's going to have some level of impact, and what that level is something actively being researched. I agree. These questions are difficult to you know, narrow it down to a very specific answer because of the lack of information. But it is interesting to hear the specific examples you can provide regarding alcohol and how it does have an effect, a negative impact on the body through many different avenues, including the gut. So I think that's always important to remember. It's whether that's going to play a role into patient care. I mean, I think we all preach to our patients that it's not good to drink alcohol. So how much of a difference is that going to make? I don't know. But I think the more that we learn, hopefully just sheds more light on the exact detriment that it has on our bodies.
Yeah. And you already mentioned it, but it's not just the alcohol in this, right? It is the fact that we're potentiating other factors, such as in this case, microbes, that enhances many of the bad outcomes of alcohol.
Thanks for listening to part one of our episode on nutritional psychiatry. Join us for part two, coming soon to our Spotify and Apple Podcast pages.